This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The season of transatlantic fashion shows is underway. New York last week, London this week, then on to Paris and Milan. All feature stoic models garbed in the latest designs for next fall, which include oversized vinyl tablecloth dresses, shirts made of trash bags, a black and white maid's uniform, and tall fur hats worthy of Dr. Seuss. From the eccentric to the outlandish, the fashion industry sets the tone for what we should be wearing. Of course, a lot of people couldn't care less what's hot on the catwalk, and a lot more blanch at the price tags or the designs or both. So what differentiates the fashionable from the rest of us? Does runway fashion matter? Does it influence your style or not? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, from fashion to toys and the meaning and the marketing behind the acronym KGOY. But first, does fashion matter? We begin with Robin Givhan, fashion editor of The Washington Post, who joins us from our studios in New York City. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
It's great to be here.
And I note in your articles reviewing some of the shows in New York, you pointed out some of those outrageous things that we mentioned in the introduction. Of course, you pointed out some much kinder words for many other things, too. But as you looked at some of these outrageous things, does anybody actually ever wear these clothes?
Well, I think, you know, the simple answer to that is, does anyone really wear the most outrageous things? No. But a lot of those things that are put on the runway that are outrageous aren't necessarily put there for someone to buy and then, you know, march down K Street wearing. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is really about trying to experiment and trying to give an artistic vision about how they see people dressing in the next season. And sometimes they use extreme measures to make their point.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to me that these designers are sponsored. They have sponsors.
Someone is actually paying for them to do this.
Yes. I'm surprised you don't see STP on the back of some of these dresses, though, of course, some of those dresses don't have backs.
Well, I think it's interesting that you point out the sponsors, because a lot of companies have realized that there is a great advantage to being connected with fashion, because it is an industry that is so surrounded by an aura of glamour. People love to be around fashion, and, you know, they have great fantasies about it. But, you know, I also often equate the runway shows with, you know, the international auto shows, because a lot of the things that you see introduced at an auto show to great fanfare and hoopla and cars being driven through mm-hmm. glass doorways will never actually appear on a car lot. But you might get a little piece of that bumper. You might get that great navigational system. You might get an interesting new color on the sales lot. So I think a lot of those same realities apply to fashion.
And there is an important distinction, as I understand it, between haute couture, the high fashion, and ready-to-wear, and both were on evidence in all of these shows.
Well, the distinction is really, it's a technical term, and technically haute couture is a French term that is used to describe clothes that are presented under the auspices of the French government that are made in a very specific way. They're handmade, and they entail a lot of hand craftsmanship, from the beading to the lace work to the embroidery, whereas in the U.S., typically when people use couture, they simply mean really expensive clothing.
Really expensive, okay.
And this was really expensive clothing on the runway.
Really expensive. How really expensive might be one of those fantastic ball gowns?
Well, if you look at a designer like Ralph Rucci, who is known for his incredibly luxurious materials, you could easily be talking $8,000 or $9,000 for a dress.
Mm-hmm. And then there are other designers who presented shows last week in New York who present coats, for example, for $700. You quoted one in one of your stories of somebody says, look, I'm not an intellectual designer. I really care how it makes my butt look.
Yeah. You know, that was the designer Philip Lim, who has a collection called 3.1 Philip Lim, which was named after the birthday on which he decided to start the collection. And you know, and he's a realist. He's someone who loves to create beautiful clothes that people would love to wear, but he doesn't have any illusions that what he's doing is, great philosophical debates. You know, he's just making nice clothes, and there was a lot of that on the runway as well.
So there is a great there's a big span between the people who are going for the very, very highest end and some people who are going aiming a bit lower.
Well, I think that's what makes the fashion industry such an interesting business to cover, because you do have people like Philip Lim who are really there just to fill your closet with great clothes, and he designs for both men and for women. And then you have a designer like Tom Brown, who's a menswear designer, and he has such a passionate point of view about with these sort of shrunken men's suits. You know, the trousers are cropped at the ankles, the jackets look like they were made for a 12-year-old. And he is really playing with proportions. I think he's an artist, he's passionate, and he may only sell a handful of suits, but I think that's okay with him.
So, yeah, obviously, people aren't going to wear that to the boardroom meeting necessarily.
Well, maybe, you know, if your boardroom is filled with toy manufacturers, they might get a kick out of
That's our
that.
next segment of the program, Robin Givhan.
Exactly.
Let's get some listeners involved in this segment of the program, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Maggie. Maggie calling us from Medford in Oregon.
Oh, wow. Hi.
Hi.
I am so glad to get to talk to you. I have listened for years, and it just seems that it's really hard to get through because you're so popular.
Oh, well, thanks very much for that.
Just wanted to say that. My take on people's influences of runway or couture fashion is I think so much of it depends on where you live and what you do, you know. I live in Medford, Oregon, which is a city of like 70,000 people in southern Oregon, and you know, we live in a valley where there's lots of farmers and stuff like that, and it's not that big a deal. We've had a couple stores try in town to sell, you know, the really high priced stuff where, you know, jeans are a couple hundred dollars and sweaters are $300. And I recently got some fantastic deals there when they went out of business. So, you know, it just and I've my personal take. I just wear what I think is comfortable and what looks good, you know, and you are somewhat limited to what the companies make and put out in their catalogs or put out on the store floor. Mm-hmm. You know, you have only certain choices, and some years they're really not that great. But anyway, that was my idea.
All right, Maggie, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You too. Thanks.
And Robin Givhan, is this a bi-coastal Chicago, Miami kind of a phenomenon, fashion?
To some degree, it is. Most designers who consider themselves to be creating fashion with a capital F and are putting their clothes on a runway would say that the vast majority of their customers are on either coast, and that is sort of in that corridor between, say, Boston and Washington, and maybe some down in Miami, and then in California, particularly in Los Angeles.
And does anybody market to Medford, Oregon?
I would say that no, they don't. And I think that's probably one of the great flaws of the fashion industry, that there is a tendency to see customers who appreciate beautiful clothing and interesting clothing that speaks to their lives as being situated in either California or New York. And they do tend to ignore, I think, the vast middle section of the country and the far corners of the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get Nellie on the line. Nellie's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. Well, hi. I actually live in Houston. I'm a jewelry designer in Houston. So I'd have to say that there's some pretty high-end designers in Houston, and they market some nice lines of clothing there. Dolce & Gabbana, Gucci, people like that all have stores in Houston. But as a jewelry designer, I have to look to what is on the runway for colors, for what my designs will go with what's in fashion now, because people want something similar, even if they can't afford something that they've seen in a magazine for for $10,000.
Robin Givon, I think that's an important point. This has repercussions throughout the entire garment industry, if you were going to use a bigger term than fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I did not mean to malign Houston or Dallas, for that matter. Lots of fashion in both places. But, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I mean, one of the great moneymakers for the overall fashion industry is the accessories part of it. And by that, I mean certainly the shoes, the handbags, and the jewelry. I mean, a company like Gucci, for instance, despite all of the publicity that it gets for its ready-to-wear, is essentially a leather goods company. They make their money from shoes and handbags. The same is true for a company like Prada. So, I mean, they really understand that for most people, the idea of spending thousands of dollars on a dress that might only have a lifespan of one season is beyond reason, and it's something they would just never even consider doing. But they will go out and spend, say, $400 on a pair of shoes. And as the saying goes, when you try on a pair of shoes, you never feel fat.
or I'm sure or a piece of jewelry, I'm sure, is the same case, Nellie.
Exactly.
Your necklace will always fit your neck mostly, but a pants might not fit your waistline.
Yeah, but are you ever afraid that the necklace is going to be in last year's color?
Well, you know, I work with gemstones a lot of times, so I'm in Tucson for the big gem and jewelry show. People come from all over the world to sell their gems, low to high end, and so I come to buy what I'm going to work for this season. So taking a cue from a lot of what's in the spring lines of the magazines is important, because if someone is very fashion conscious, they're going to want a look that's from the magazine, whether they can afford that specific item or not.
Mm-hmm. And we just have a few seconds left, but in brief, what are you looking for?
Well, I don't know. It's stones that I like. I bought a lot of blue and pink opals and a lot of sea foam colors this year. So I don't know. That's what I like.
Okay.
So I'm going to work with what I like in stones.
Nellie, good luck to you. And thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking with Robin Givon, the fashion editor for The Washington Post, on the subject of, does fashion matter? If so, why? If not, why not? Join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan from NPR News. It's Fashion Week in London, and as models strut down the runway in everything from tweed to trash bags, we're asking the question, does fashion matter? Our guest is Robin Givon, fashion editor for The Washington Post. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Valerie Steele, director and curator of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology. She joins us from her office in Manhattan. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here.
Now, you have clothes at the museum that are considered art pieces. So where is the line between what's considered imaginative or artsy and wearable clothes?
Well, I don't think that you could say that our clothes are considered art pieces. It would really depend on who you were asking. There's a big debate about whether fashion is art. Certainly some kinds of fashion are very artfully made or very innovative. But I think that whole idea, in the past, people thought art was something timelessly beautiful and fashion was just something that changed constantly. That's kind of an old-fashioned idea after you have Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes. The whole idea, what is art, is more complicated than we'd think.
And maybe a subject for another day. Nevertheless, what still gets back to the point, what separates these very high-end items from wearable clothes?
Well, we have things which are wearable clothes. Let me say, different fashion museums have different approaches. The Costume Institute chooses things which they see as being art, often haute couture, runway pieces. Museum of the City of New York chooses things made or worn in New York. Museum at FIT chooses things which we see as being on the cutting edge of fashion. Not necessarily haute couture, could be street style, could be hip-hop style, goth or punk style, but something that we see as being influential for what makes other fashion designers sit up and take notice.
Mm-hmm. For example, and I know you're especially familiar with the history of high-heeled shoes. These are devices much admired by men and much described by many of the women I know as devices invented by Torquemada. Why have they withstood the test of time?
Well, because there's a little bit of Imelda Marcos in a lot of women. High-heeled shoes are one of the prime kind of erotic images of femininity. And although a lot of women find them uncomfortable, I'm looking down, I'm wearing what just like sort of lace-up shoes, which are 1.5 inches, so mm-hmm. like men's shoes. A lot of women really love high heels. I remember we did a show called Shoes, A Lexicon of Style, and we had a whole section specifically on heels and then others on boots and sandals, including comfortable Birkenstock sandals. And we had one Brazilian TV reporter who came running in with her crew, ran straight to the Birkenstocks and screamed, "No Latin woman would wear horrible shoes like these." You know, she wanted shoes that were, she saw as being sexy and feminine, and high heels fit the ticket. So it's a choice. In the past, maybe you had to wear certain styles that went in or out, but nowadays there's a wide range of styles that you can choose from, and a lot of women vote with their feet, and they choose the high heels.
All right. Let's see if we get some listeners back on the line. And let's go to, this is Jim. Jim's with us from Temescal Valley. Am I pronouncing that right?
You are pronouncing it correctly, yes.
Go ahead, please.
I grew up in Hollywood. My father was an actor. I'm in my mid-60s, and so I've seen a lot of fashions come and go. Grew up in the industry, and most of the people that I knew back then, actors, some very, very famous people, I'm not going to go into names now, were perfectly happy, even though they had access to studio clothing and everything else, perfectly happy running around in their cowboy boots, jeans, and an old shirt. And it seems like anything else, people are very driven by what they're kind of told to do, most people being followers. And I think a lot of the fashion industry is a self-perpetuating industry, because you come out with a line of clothing and people go out and spend $2,000 or $3,000 one year, and then some fashion designer or whomever you happen to be following the following year says, "No, this is out. We want you to spend $2,000 or $3,000 more on clothing." And I really don't see the practicality of that when, you know, a good pair of clothing is going to last you a long time. Mm-hmm. Why do this? You know, you could probably best spend your money in other devices.
We'll get
I'll take my answer offline.
All right. And I'll just note that it's interesting that he described his business, the movie business, as the industry. I suspect that, Robin Givhan, am I correct that in the fashion industry they call that business the industry?
Yes, they do.
I figured they did.
But, you know, I think it's interesting that that fashion always sort of seems to get this bum rap, especially when you start talking about very high-end, expensive fashion, because people tend to say, well, why would anyone ever need to spend $2,000 on a jacket when one that costs $100 is just fine and is just as nice? And there are a lot of people who feel that way, and they spend $100 on a jacket, and life goes on. But I would also argue that there are a lot of people who, again, to use the auto industry, look at people who spend $80,000 on a car and say, what are you, mad? You could spend $20,000 and still get from point A to point B.
And let me ask you, Valerie, the same question, but in the form of this email that we have from David in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My girlfriend has been trying to convince me for years that $1,000 or $500 price tag on designer bag or shoes are reasonable. I am unswayed. What's the sense of paying that much if the materials and craftsmanship are the same as significantly cheaper ones?
Well, very often the materials and craftsmanship are not the same. I went to a shoe factory once in Italy, and you could see how the $500 pair of shoes was a combination of really high technology with lasers and so on, and hand workmanship with stitching and using leather instead of using cheaper materials to make it. So some of it's the fact that the shoes are going to be high fashion in terms of trendy, but some of it is that they're much better quality. I think it's like the what Robin said. Do you want a car or do you want a Porsche? You know, do you want a cheap pair of shoes or do you want a really well-made pair of shoes? The well-made pair will last longer, so it might turn out not to be that much more expensive.
Okay.
And, you know, Neil, on that same topic, I would also add that part of what the fashion industry is selling is not merely a dress. It's a designer dress, and it's all the fantasy and all of the image making and all of the glamour that sort of rolled into that. I mean, there's a reason why fashion advertising is so otherworldly sometimes, because they're really tapping into fantasy and the idea of the way that we would like to be, perhaps, and not necessarily the way that we are.
And I think it's important to realize that people are not just being suckered by advertising, though. It's not the idea of a cabal of designers.
Right.
Things like names are also ruled by fashion. Everybody decides they're going to name their child Jennifer or Christopher or whatever. Those names change according to fashion. There's no industry that tries to bribe you to name your child Christopher. You decide it, but fashion plays an influence in that.
To be fair, though, Robin, you did write in your series of articles about the week this past week in New York that, in fact, the fashion industry, or the industry, to use your terminology, could probably use a little bit more skepticism as people walk down the runways in utterly outrageous costumes. Nobody laughed. Nobody snickered. Nobody said anything.
No, it's true. I think that, you know, there should be, you know, a nice balance there, because there are certainly times when things appear on the runway and the idea of this, you know, sort of wonderful fantasy has truly been left behind and you've got practically a nightmare on the runway. And there is an incredibly high tolerance for any idea. And I often think that the industry would be better served if there was a bit more self-criticism rather than having to get it all from customers who feel like they've been completely either deserted or insulted.
Yeah, you say the industry, in fact, needs to learn how to boo.
I mean, I don't want, the audience to suddenly start throwing rotten tomatoes on the runway. But I do think that sometimes the industry needs to hear from within its own group that, hey, that's a bad idea. That's awful, or that's insulting. I mean, things sometimes come down the runway. For instance, dresses that the models can barely even walk in because the hem is so narrow. I mean, someone should say, don't send that down the runway. That's not only just unattractive, that's really insulting to adult women.
Here's an email we have from Najia in Kansas City, Missouri. Just as American women look at covered Muslim women with pity, so do Muslim women view Western society and its obsession with fashion. We consider the fashion industry to be a form of oppression, sucking millions of dollars from women, making them feel inadequate if they're not able to match the fashions, and depressing regular women who can't achieve the current ideal weight or hair type, all in an effort to please men. Now, she concludes, now that is oppression. I suspect you would disagree, Valerie Steele.
Arab women buy a lot of fashion. If you go anywhere in the Middle East, you'll find tremendous purchases of fashion. The whole French couture industry would have collapsed without all of the fashion they're buying. But they buy it to wear indoors with other women. Hmm. So I think that Western women as well buy and wear sometimes sexier fashion for a variety of reasons, and not just because they're out to please men or please some kind of fantasy image of men. I think the view is too oversimplified.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Victoria. Victoria with us from Cincinnati.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, I have a lot of cognitive dissonance about the fashion industry, because when you look at the statistics that indicate that over 60% of Americans are overweight or obese, I'm really curious, how does the fashion industry cater to the wants and desires of those women who wish they could wear those items on the runway, but yet are compelled to buy things that are less fashionable?
Robin Givon.
Well, I think that there's definitely a disconnect between the designers who are creating the very expensive, more leading-edge collections and a more mass-market company, because when you look at those, oftentimes you'll see that a mass market company has extended its sizing up to, say, a 16, not going, you know, into plus sizes, whereas when you look at the designers, and they usually end their sizing at about a 12, but they also include sizes 0 and 2 on the other end. And part of that is, I believe, truly just designers' sort of snobbery. They want to dress what they believe is sort of the ideal figure. And for them, as they expand beyond sizes 12s and 14s, it then becomes a different kind of design challenge for them. The same dress that's cut as a 2, you have to make changes in order to make that same silhouette flattering on a much larger size. I mean, I think that it's certainly a problem because there's a huge market out there of people who are not being served.
Oh, I think it'd be, yeah, a wonderful, lucrative business for designers to, you look at larger-sized women like Queen Latifah or Delta Burke, who have obviously very lovely women of larger size, and I think it would be wonderful if the fashion industry would try and focus on people who are actually the majority as opposed to the minority, like the runway models, and I think this would also help to minimize the incidence of eating disorders among women who try to aspire to a figure that can't fit in those size 0 and size 2 outfits.
Well, you know, one of the issues, though, is that for a very long time, the fashion industry believed that women who were larger would not spend the money on designer clothes. And after having spoken with some designers, one of the other things that I learned is that it's not that they are being, they're not getting this great demand from the size 16s and 18s to make the clothes in their size, or they're not the ones coming in looking for their size. What they're finding is that smaller and smaller women are coming in, and I'm talking sizes 0s and size 2s, saying, you know, we want those clothes. I mean, there's a much greater demand at the small end than at the larger end, or at least that's what some designers are saying.
Victoria, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We're talking about why fashion matters with Robin Givhan of the Washington Post and Valerie Steele of the Museum of the Fashion Institute of Technology. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get Steve on the line. Steve, very patient with us from Sacramento, California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Neil.
Sure.
This question of does fashion matter, I think it matters to the extent that it's congruent with how fine art matters. It's an expression of artistic trends much in the same way as, you know, a practical way that architecture is, and that, the direct consumers of fine art are a very small minority of those who ultimately are influenced by the trends that are shown.
Hmm. So it has repercussions not only throughout the rest of the clothing industry and but through the rest of society, you think, Steve?
That's exactly what I'm saying, and I'd say that's true with any of the I don't know what to call them, even practical arts that are influenced by trends that occur in the fine arts. I don't see it occurring in a vacuum at all.
Valerie Steele, what do you think?
I think that's absolutely true, Steve. Fashion's a part of visual culture, and even if you can't afford to or don't want to buy an haute couture gown by Galliano, you're consuming the images. People see these images on television, on the internet, they're aware of them, and there's this kind of floating conversation between visual people. Some of the same kind of imagery will occur in an ad or a movie that had nothing to do with the original fashion runway.
Yeah, to that extent, I'd say it matters very much beyond the commercial area that haute couture may occupy.
And obviously, we did call it the industry, Robin Givhan. This is a big business, especially there in New York.
Oh, absolutely. And I would say that anyone who has ever shopped at a Club Monaco or an H&M or The Gap, for that matter, has in some way consumed a small piece of, you know, what we see on runways. I mean, fashion has become so incredibly democratized as the industry has grown and become a much more commercial, public company, shareholder invested kind of business.
So my Blue Gap sweater is in really fact a cerulean, and I owe it all to Meryl Streep?
Yes, you do.
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it. And we'd like to thank our guests today, Valerie Steele, director and curator of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology, who joined us today from her office in Manhattan in New York City. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Robin Gavon, fashion editor for The Washington Post, who was kind enough to come in and join us from our bureau in New York City. Nice view from there today, isn't it, Robin?
It's a beautiful view.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
When we come back, we're going to switch from fashion to toys and find out the big buzzword at this year's Toy Fair, and that is K-Goy. We'll explain it after we come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.